Working Class Heroes being the name of it, what role do you think music can play now? You're releasing these older songs in 2019 with a completely different, but very familiar in many ways, set of issues dealing with class, dealing with, you know, we're in the rural high plains. We've got a lot of farmers. We've got a lot of oil and gas. We've got a lot of agriculture. Everywhere has a lot of problems with healthcare. Our rural hospitals closing down. This has to be on people's minds. Yet here we are. We've got this very polarized sense of politics. But to me, the people haven't changed in any way. The people that I know, and I'm not from this area as much. I'm from Kansas City, Missouri originally, just to the east of us. But I grew up in a union household. I grew up with working class people. I feel like the kindness, the support, the help, the authenticity in its authentic term is definitely there. People do want a good life. They want to be able to make it. These songs coming out in 2019 with a very direct message, how do you feel that folk music, knowing that there is not even a renaissance, it hasn't gone anywhere and it's strong right now. The problem is that you don't hear it that much. It's not on commercial radio. It's public radio, it's community radio, and it's college and education radio. That's the place where you hear these songs, and those places have a specific audience, and that's not a huge audience. So what do you feel about this music's role right now and its development of that message in a class consciousness?
Well, I think there are a couple parts to the answer. One part is fundamental to music itself, and that's something that people need to be reminded of from time to time, and that is that music is not just a product, it's an activity. It's not just something you consume, it's something you do. Music is doing. And what this kind of music reminds people of is that they can sing, they can participate. And as far as I'm concerned, participation is the most important part, not observation, not consumption, not spectator sport. It's activity. It's being engaged in the music making process. That's point one. Point two is that it's true that the dominance of the media, of the culture industry, if you want to call it that, movies, television, and music, is great. There's no question. You can't escape it. And in fact, long after this music was originally composed, the Muzak Corporation was invented to present music wherever you are. And ever since then, music has become sonic wallpaper. It is essentially something you can't turn off, you cannot escape, and you don't listen to. So the ultimate effect is that music's power to mobilize, to unite, to raise the spirit of human beings who want to be free is diluted and weakened, and the attention is diverted into narcissism, self, you know, navel gazing, and me. And that's not what this music is about. And what we're trying to show is that by participating in an activity of this kind, you can enrich yourself and enjoy it more than you can with all this other stuff. While at the same time, it does actually serve a higher purpose, and that purpose is collective, it's human, it's solidarity, it's people working together to make the world a better place for everyone. And that's what this is about, and that to me is what music is ultimately about. That is the mission that music has, and not just, as I said, sonic wallpaper or something that you can't turn off.
The picture on the cover of your album, iconic Dorothea Lange Great Depression era photo, which is called Toward Los Angeles, California, 1937. Folks probably have seen this 1,000 times when you're seeing images of the Great Depression. Do you see a resonance between what's happening in those earlier periods, those folks walking down the street, 1930s, and now? And if so, in what ways?
The resonance in some ways is really obvious in the sense of a Great Depression, 1929, and the financial crisis of 2008. They call it the Great Recession. I mean, what do these words mean? It's like authenticity. I mean, the words are bandied about like ping pong balls, but they don't actually say anything. The fact is that, you know, literally millions of American people lost their homes. They had their lives devastated by this casino capitalism, as everybody calls it. And so it was, in that sense, there was an obvious similarity between 1929 and 2008. And of course, the other side is that, you know, the threat of war, which was looming at that time. At that point, the fascists in Europe were rising. Mussolini had been in power for about 7 years. Hitler had not yet been elected, but the Nazis were on the rise. And so on. All of this, mind you, preceding 1940, the book Hard-Hitting Songs was originally assembled at that time. So it's all kind of leading up to those things, just as we're faced with today, not exactly in the same form. The form may be different. It may not be brown shirts. It may be suits and ties. But basically, it's the same thing, you know, where you've got people being hounded and hassled for the way they appear or what their lifestyle is or whatever it is. Or particularly in the case of the working class, because they don't come from the United States, they come from Mexico or they come from some other place seeking employment and so on. So, I mean, there are obvious differences, but there are also obvious similarities. And I think that the reason that the lyrics to some of these songs sound so timely is because things haven't changed. You know, when John Hancock sings The Rich Man Boasts and Brags While the Poor Man Goes in Rags, I mean, come on, it's relative. Maybe you're not wearing rags, but I mean, when I think of San Francisco, where I come from, and the 55,000 homeless people on the street, that's close enough to rags. So, you know, it may be symbolism, but it's essentially the same, where you have great poverty in what is supposed to be the richest country on earth, and you have incredible wealth. And so ultimately, this inequality is what stands out. And the outcry of these songs essentially is the demand for equality, that we should share and share alike, that we should not be divided and stratified this way.
And I think that brings up a good point. In the picture, you know, we're seeing folks that you can assume are likely farmers, factory workers, miners. These are the types of industries that we're hearing specifically about in a lot of these songs. But now we're looking at labor politics in 2019. We're hearing about undercompensated healthcare workers. We're hearing about transportation sector, up into pilots. You know, NPR covered stories about pilots that make 17 grand and work 80 hours a week. And you're like, wait, you're flying my plane? Education, those who work in food service. Do you think that now that we've got a kind of separate kind of industries, things that previously were considered higher, more white collar, does the labor music that speaks to these current industries have to change as well?
Well, yes and no. I mean, on the one hand, it's music will always develop and people will experiment with everything from electronics to guitars, you know. I mean, and there's just as much great music being made today that's contemporary in style as there was in the 1920s. In that sense, I don't think there's any real problem with music. There's enough good music being made. The connection has to be made, though, between the music and the struggle. And that's where doing something like what we're doing, which is so explicit and so clear, we're hoping that will inspire people to do their own thing. In other words, take this as an incentive or a motivating factor to link up whatever kind of music you do to the struggle of healthcare providers or all these teachers that are going on strike, and, you know, write songs that are appropriate to their struggle yourself, or adapt a song from here and put a hip hop beat underneath it. You know, no problem. There's mean things happening in this land can have a hip hop beat. I can tell you, there's certain things that, you know, speak like that, you know, where it's just so clear that it can be translated and you know, moved around lyrically or musically to fit any particular struggle that might be going on. I would just add that the fact that there may not be as many or the percentage of people in certain industries like automobile industry or coal or whatever, or you might say the traditional industrial occupations as there are now in teaching, or what you mentioned, you know, healthcare provision, all of these so-called service industries. I mean, they're service industries, but they're absolutely essential. You can't have human life if you don't have healthcare. You can't have a society without education. And the fact that so many of these industries were, until recently, disorganized or unorganized, and to a certain extent feminized. Women were the main workers in these industries, and were given lower wages because they were women, and therefore it made the industries profitable, which is actually, interestingly enough, very similar to the story of Ella Mae Wiggins and the Textile Workers Union, because they hired a lot of women in those textile plants because they could pay them less wages.
Yeah, and we're still seeing that now. There are stories every single day that we're hearing about people of color, women, getting paid significantly less. And I think it's still shocking to people, but I don't know how it's still shocking to people, being these industries that are essential. I think a lot of people might believe that the labor movement, the strength of the labor movement, is maybe behind us. Do you think that, you know, a strong labor movement is a thing of the past and we're going to see it continue chipping away? Or do you feel like what we're seeing with these teacher strikes, what we're seeing with people just, like, you know, demanding to get some kind of organization, fight for 15 to get a decent living wage, do you think that it's going to slowly start going up? This is one of those speculative questions. Just curious, since you have so much, you know, depth into the history of it.
The speculative part, I can only hope. But in terms of what the signs are, or what the actual, you know, conditions are, I think that it has to. In other words, there's a certain point at which people will fight, even if it's like just to survive. And when people are being pushed to that level, which I think many people are, then they are going to resist. And once you start resisting, you seek allies, you seek people to join with. You don't want to fight alone. I think the real problem in the United States, and it's not confined to the United States either, I mean, it's true here too, in Europe and other parts of the world, is the individualism, this notion that it's, you know, my problem and it's my fault and I'm the one to blame, you know, and so on, which of course is what you're being told. And that your freedom is so that you can sit in front of your television watching TV, eating popcorn or something. That's freedom. And when you're pressed to the wall and you're actually starving to death, or you're being thrown out of your house because of a mortgage or whatever, that starts to make you consider, is it really my fault? You know, am I really the one to blame? And then when you start to ask those kinds of questions and seek to unite with your fellow workers, with other people in your conditions, then whatever form the organization takes, whatever form the struggle takes, that, you know, emerges over time. In other words, I'm not sure to what extent organized labor as it's presently constituted will have to evolve and change, whether there's going to be cooperatives, are there going to be factory takeovers, as there have been in Argentina, where the workers actually run the factory? Is that the future? That could very well be. It could be that what happens is that workers simply decide, okay, unions aren't enough. We've got to take over the state. We have to actually organize the way things are distributed. I mean, if you're a teacher and you're employed by the state, then how are you going to take it over? You've got to confront the government. You've got to actually organize yourself, whether it's electorally or some other way, to actually seize the power that you need to change your situation. And that, to me, will not stop. And in fact, I would add that the reasons that, you know, the present administration and others go to such lengths to 24/7 pump out stuff that has nothing to do with the lives of the American people is because they're afraid that the American people are going to realize what their situation is and unite and organize. So they've got everybody talking about stuff that has nothing to do with real life. 24/7, it's all the time. Why would they have to spend all that energy and money if they weren't worried about the people themselves realizing what's actually going on and taking matters into their own hands? Because that's what it's all about. That's what these, for me, the most inspiring thing about the teachers is that teachers are what it's really all about. You know, education. How are you going to raise the next generation? How are you going to give the people the knowledge they need to make the world that they want to live in? That's the question.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have coverage over the Oklahoma Panhandle. There's been quite a bit of education coverage about the state of Oklahoma, strikes there, and, you know, having just untenable working conditions. I mean, having 45 kids in a classroom, just the brain drain, people leaving because it's just they don't want to, but they are abandoning, you know, people that are not going to be learning. And it's rough, you know. I look back, I grew up in the, you know, early 80s in Missouri, and the education that I feel I got and that I was receiving when I graduated high school, I look at the quality of kids who are graduating high school now, and I'm seeing a deficit. So I agree. If you don't graduate high school with critical thinking skills, the ability to read a novel, and the ability to write a basic sentence. And there is definitely a deficit there, having worked with kids. Speaking of the panhandles, and of course, Texas, though still not sure why we call it a panhandle. Woody Guthrie, obviously, you know, Pampa, Texas, that's in our listener region. We've got the Woody Guthrie Folk Music Center that we have in Pampa. This is something that kind of came up here. And you have a Woody Guthrie cover on this album. And I'm just, you know, kind of curious, the cultural history of this region. Obviously, we were just ground zero for the Dust Bowl. You know, Boise City, Oklahoma, that's right here. That's where we are. And there are people that remember that. You can look at it and you can just imagine this dust storm coming over. And the history feels very close to me, having been transplanted here. And I'm just curious, this is not a region right now that's known for being very pro-labor. You know, Texas is a right-to-work state. You've got a lot of feeders. You've got a lot of cattle. You've got a lot of agriculture, and we're seeing a lot of issues with farming right now. We're hearing these, you know, bailouts. We're hearing we've got catastrophic weather right now. There's just an inordinate amount of flooding in Nebraska, in Kansas. These are things that are affecting the people that listen to High Plains Public Radio right now. And you have to wonder, you know, these are the people that are trying to maintain this land. Many of whom, you know, are just trying to look for some help, but idealistically do not want, quote, a government handout. They want to be able to do their work. A lot of the different trade policies and tariff things that are going on affecting them. This music, the songs, you know, how do you think this, the relevance of these types of new challenges that didn't really, they did exist back then. The Dust Bowl was an agricultural man-made problem. How do you think that these songs maybe could still affect and kind of like folks here reflect on it and take something away from it very personally?
Well, I think the spirit, first of all, the fighting spirit is one important element. These are not sad songs, you know. These are not songs bemoaning suffering. There are songs that are calling to fight against suffering, and they're calling on workers and farmers to band together to, you know, fight back. That's the message over and over again in song after song. That's point one. Point two is that, yes, the question of climate change is a new development. You know, you can make a corollary with the Dust Bowl, but, you know, climate change is obviously something that's exponentially greater. It's affecting the entire planet, and it's you know, there's no escaping the consequences of it, and we have to deal with that as a species, in a way. All of humanity has to band together to get, you know, the changes that are required. But even there, I think the sense that ordinary people, in other words, the people who actually are the producers of things, the producers of food, the producers of healthcare, the producers of communications, the producers of education, and so on and so forth, the actual people who make things and do the work, are the ones who are going to have to force the change. It's not coming from a savior. It's not coming from the government. And if you're going to force the government to change, or you're going to force a transformation that brings about a new government, then that's going to have to answer to the people directly. There can't be this fuzzy line between the elected representative and the whoever. It's got to be accountable to a strong majority of people who are organized to actually enforce their will. That's the key question. That's what was being sung about in these songs, was that we, not I, we have to unite and fight together. Otherwise, nothing's going to change. It's just going to get worse. And that message has not changed. That's still the same thing, you know. And when you read after this, you know, the book that goes along with this comes out in September. That was a decision of the various parties in publishing this thing to put the CD out first. But when people get the book, they can read what Ella May said. I mean, her words are so heartfelt. They're so simple and direct, but they are really, really clear about, you know, we must band together. If we don't stand together, then we're finished. We can't move forward. So that, I think that speaks to a farmer in Nebraska. It speaks to a teacher in West Virginia. It speaks to my son, who's a teacher in San Diego, teaching 9-year-old kids in a public school. Same thing. They're in these general ways, in these big broad categories, the message is the same, and it's for everyone, not for any particular group.
Folks, we've been speaking with Matt Callahan. He is one of the two folks that does the album Working Class Heroes, A History of Struggle and Song, with his partner Yvonne Moore. The book comes out in September. That is news. I'm glad I get to know that as well. We're going to be spinning this music in rotation. And Matt, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate having really good folk music to play. And I love the history of it as well.
Okay. Thank you so much, Jenny. Much appreciated.